Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. This is a continuation of episode 136, a special episode in which we revisit one of our prior conversations on a classic of organization theory. This is a re-release of episode 6, part 2, where Dimitris, Pedro, Miranda, and Ralph discussed Max Weber's famous book chapter, Bureaucracy, published in his 1922 book, Economy and Society. To learn more about the text and the original episode, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
I think a good way to restart and resume our discussion is to think of one of the core principles of bureaucracy, which is rules. We talked about them a bit in the first part, and we discussed a bit of the situation in which they become too complex, how we are supposed to deal with that, and the fact that Weber never spoke about how rules are changed. But I think there are also other aspects. Does anyone has anything to say about that?
Yeah, so I was actually thinking during our discussion that if I could choose the main point that I think Weber missed out on, it's actually the idea of the understanding of the rules, in the sense that in his entire discussion, there is no mention of should people understand the rules. There is no mention of where do these rules come from. There is no mention of what is the purpose of these rules. So I think a lot of the problems that I have and that maybe you have with the reading is linked to this idea, which could actually play out on a lot of levels. So I was thinking that the first level could be a motivational level, in the sense that if I understand better this rule, what's the purpose of this rule and where it comes from, I as a worker could apply it better. So I actually work better. And then I was thinking, okay, but what about the complexity of rules? If you get an understanding of the rules, of what's the purpose and where they come from, then obviously you can draw a line when there are too many, when there are too few. Because It seems to me that Weber has this kind of like ideal view that the more rules you have, the better it is. But even in our everyday life, this is like a general struggle that I have with the idea of bureaucracy. So this was my thought on the reading.
I think this notion of what the rules mean is absolutely great. It's easy when the rule is take X and bring it from location 1 to location 2. That's easy. But what if the rule is provide a friendly customer service, or even a more basic subset of that, smile when you're dealing with customers, for example? So how much do you smile? When does smile become creepy? Are the circumstances when you shouldn't smile, perhaps? Things like that. As you pointed out, Miranda, rules are not objective in that kind of way that Weber wants them to be. So how does understanding the rule actually contribute to the whole efficiency ethos?
Well, comment I want to make on that smiling thing is the current practice when you call someone for a software problem, they, after you describe the problem, they spend another 30 seconds telling you how they understand your feelings, that you're frustrated. And so now I can tell that's a rule they're following. And I also, probably because of bad behavior on my part, it irritates me because I question the sincerity because I know they're following a script in some way. Yeah. And so I get frustrated when I'm listening to that. One thing I want to add, the way that Miranda broke it down, which I thought was excellent, is this idea I have a flexibility, right? And really, Dimitri, you were talking about it. That's just the word I wanted to use to describe it. Because how do you have a rule that tells people to be flexible? I don't think every matches or balances properly. And so that's what I think Dimitri was talking about. You can't have a rule that covers every single circumstance. Otherwise, the rule book gets to be. And it forgets about whether people could follow it or not. It's not possible. You have a rule that covers every circumstance. So I think maybe it's oxymoronic to use the ox analogy again. But
yes,
I'm not original. Yeah, I know it's already been copyrighted, so I just copied. But it's oxymoronic to talk about rule-based flexibility.
Okay.
I really like where this is going, because I just want to add more on this whole issue of how the rules are understood. Because for me, I have to think about that. I'm going to sprinkle some politics here and the whole thing of, you know, why people follow orders and so on and so forth. Which for me, the point is that people, when they come to the workplace, they don't find a rule as a disembodied thing, but they find managers, for instance. So they found a personalization of the rules. And the case that we're bringing of the employee saying, oh, I understand their feelings, so on and so forth, it might be the head supervisor just hanging around, or just, you know, his talk is going to be monitored later. In the process of understanding, I have to understand that also the person relates to the rule usually via someone else, a manager or a superior, for that matter.
Well, it's one way the rules. I mean, you get some rules come out of books and instructions and manuals and stuff. But I think Peter brings up a really good point, is that some other portion of them are embodied. They come to you through managers or your peers, mm-hmm. or some, you know, some other person in the organization. So to say that they're all the same, just because, so that I and the organization would treat the rule exactly the same, regardless of where it came from, my peer Pedro or my superior Miranda, I think is superficial.
So they are embodied in a way. That's true, and that's a good point. But a different way how rules are expressed is through restrictions that technology placed on you. Something came to mind as I was trying to get a refund for a light bulb that I purchased at the fuel station together with some fuel. And the computer would not allow to refund the petrol for obvious reasons.
Okay.
But because petrol was in the same receipt as the light bulb, basically that was the rule for the people who tried to help me, in that they physically could not break the rule because the technology would not allow it. And you see this in banks as well. Sometimes the clerks are trying to do something and the system will not let them. So there are physical restrictions, or physical to an extent, that rules can place on what you can and cannot do, even in the absence of managers who embody the rules, even on the managers who embody the rules as well.
Yeah, that's a good point.
No, I agree fully. I don't want to be a whole, you know, it's all the humans.
That's okay with me. I that's my focus, so be my guest.
I mean, you know, the technology is not born out of nowhere.
Right. So speaking of technology, I think that's there's a comment I wanted to make about that. Weber makes a comment on page. Right, so on page 224, only by reversion to small-scale organization would it be possible to any considerable extent to escape the influence of bureaucracy. And I thought that was an amazing statement. The way it comes across when I read it was he's trying to say, there's really no going back, and you're not going to, you know, bureaucracy is the way of the future. And yet, that foreshadows a lot of the modern technology where we're not making 100,000, you know, things. We're making, many organizations are making them in small groups, or you're customizing services for some organization. So isn't that scaling back to smaller organizations or processes that gives people the flexibility and opportunity for innovation in our mm-hmm. current society? So I think it's interesting. I mean, I can't really tell if that's what he was thinking about stuff like that, because to me it looked like he was saying it was a negative thing, but it's interesting that he did at least address it.
I just want to say something quick, because I was just reflecting on the thing I said before about managers, but I think what I'm trying to say is that if you think about the ideal type, the point is that rules interact with other aspects of the ideal type of bureaucracy, which is in this case hierarchy. So I think in thinking of how people understand rules and the motivation that they take out of them and reflect of them, we have to also understand there is like a hierarchy that usually is going to enforce a kind of understanding of a rule or the other. But I think that's the point.
Yeah, that's actually a great point, and I'll give you a military example. So we have lots of rules in the military. Some are more important than others. Mm-hmm. And we go to some lengths to explain, okay, well, here's the kind of things that can get you shot, you know, because you're not following the rules. And we don't need to do that currently, but, you know, get yourself in judicial trouble. Here's mm-hmm. where there is some room for interpretation. But one of my favorite is in the manuals that are just these huge collections of rules and procedures and that sort of thing for operating a nuclear power plant. And they make a point of identifying in the training process, there's only one rule that is actually in the manuals, and it's the same for all the Navy ships, that is actually capitalized. And they said, we do that for a reason, because it is so important. It's much more important than all the other rules. And it is the nature of a safety procedure. I won't go into details more, but it's a safety procedure or safety a philosophy or approach that can be summed up in one sentence. And that sentence is the only one in all caps in the manuals. So, Peter, you're absolutely correct. There is, you need to put some attention into, well, what's this hierarchy of rules? one of the rules that, you know, under no circumstances do you ever break them.
I'm just curious what this rule is.
Yeah, I'm curious. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I took you down the dark path. So the rule is that you shall never violate cold water interlocks. And so cold water is a very bad thing in Western design reactors, less of an issue in Soviet reactors, but that's another story, or Western reactors. And so what cold water will do is it will make the reactor power level go up so fast your instruments can't catch the increase, and you're going to damage the reactor, damage people by the reactor power increasing exponentially without bounds and causing all sorts of destruction. And so it was, so Chernobyl was a power excursion, but it wasn't caused by cold water. It was caused by a different cause. But in Western reactors, that's the one thing for which you can't really design protection. And the interlocks are not, they're a combination of physical and mechanical electronic barriers, but they can be defeated. And so that's why they say that under no circumstances will you ever defeat a cold water interlock. And that is it. All kept.
Okay.
Right.
Now
something new.
I wanted to...
I couldn't resist.
So I was thinking about this whole thing that Miranda brought up, and you know, the whole thing of motivation, and you know, I think something that you said before of flexibility, Ralph, and Dimitris as well, is that I keep thinking that there are some organizational forms which are very bureaucratic. I'm going to say it again. It's the Toyota case, because many people have insisted that one of the things that make it positive is that although it creates more formalization, it also empowers workers to change them. Would you see something like that in the military, for instance, Ralph? This counterbalance for so much rules and bureaucracy and complexity being just under, because what you're saying, I think at the on part one was a bit about so how certain rules are more important than others, and there are sometimes some place that you can flexibilize things. But one thing is to find workaround for rules, and one thing is to find a reflective moment and say, okay, we are going to change the rules, which is
right. All right. So we do have that, and because a lot of the work we do in Navy ships and in maintenance of Navy ships, where I have a lot of experience, like I said earlier, you cannot imagine all circumstances all the time. And therefore, you're going to get some places where you've got rules, but they're incomplete or insufficient, or the actual rule tells you to do something that you don't want done. And so what we stress in those circumstances is they say, look, we want you to follow the rules. However, follow the rules, and this is something we're very, this is maybe another rule, but this is more of a guideline, so we're not making a rule. These following rules is important. However, we do not excuse dogmatic following of rules to the extent that you're not using your thinking abilities. And therefore, you think there's a reason that the rule is insufficient or it needs to be revised or it needs to be changed. What we tell people is don't just do a workaround, because then it goes back to the Weber dictum of making sure it's written down and documented. So they say, look, you can't just go create the rule locally, but you are expected to stop and get direction or get assistance to update the rule and change it or modify it or identify where it wasn't correct. So that applies a lot. And that depends on the more complicated work forms, like Dimitri was talking about, where it's more complicated work or the technology has these limitations built in, where you just can't foresee every circumstance, which I think is work that Weber was not anticipating.
Okay.
Which is, I'm not criticizing him for that. Mm-hmm. But we have some kind of rules where it's, okay, you always do these things the same way. And I'll give you an example. So for example, when somebody operates machinery, and in this case, it's a valve that basically allows water or not to flow down a pipe, you don't want everybody coming up with their own rules for doing that. You want a standard way of doing it every single time so you get reproducible results. Yeah. However, inside those rules, there are areas where you're going to actually have to ask for help, or you're going to need some guidance or assistance or something like that. And that's where we build in more flexibility. So there's that balance to that I was talking about, where you do want to get predictable results. But in the larger scheme of things, many times that doesn't help you to say, I want predictable results, because the rules are insufficient. So then you have to get clarification or a change.
What you said about reproducible results and predictable results, I think that's quite key to this reading, because you have not mentioned once that this makes it more or less efficient, but rather more or less predictable. And I think that's something to touch upon, as well as, do we want to pursue that?
Well, sure. I actually wrote down a note that Weber was talking about efficiency, that this idea that what made the bureaucratic organizations more rational and therefore superior to the other forms of organization, because they were efficient. But and I know this on page 223, but I kind of scratch my head and just say, well, he doesn't really define what that means inside the chapter. Now, Edgar, I'd like you on this. But he does know, what he says is that precision in the superiority derives from, sorry, precision, stability, discipline, and reliability. That's why I keep emphasizing those, because lots of rules help you in those kinds of cases. So, Pedro, I'm curious.
Right. No, I think it's actually something very interesting, because there is some, I remember I read the text. I can't remember the name of the author, but I can show that in the blog later, is that the idea that rationalization or even efficiency is the way to describe what Weber is talking about is actually is an interpretation of Weber read via Taylor. You know, that has been very diffused in America because, of course, Weber was read after Taylor was already known, and because it was translated only after. So people link Weber to the idea of a more efficient workplace. But actually what he was stressing was more something along the lines about uncertainty reduction. He used the term efficiency, but you know, very rarely. And if you wait, he uses much less in comparison to other terms that he used, like precision, strict discipline, reliability, as you said, stability. So it's more about the calculability of results, you know, being sure about what's going to happen, than necessarily, you know, doing it quick. I think that was linked to the whole idea that we were talking about before.
I think that's something very important to be conscious of.
Yeah.
It does, however, lead me to a somewhat critical point. You know, in chapter 11, he goes on for quite a while listing historical instances of what he believes to be bureaucracy-like forms of organization. Yeah. And he's particularly fond of ancient Egypt for that reason. So if it's not about efficiency necessarily, and it's about reducing uncertainty, or increasing predictability rather, just to be a devil's advocate, why is it that bureaucracy is a superior form of organizing, he does say that, to non-bureaucracies, if non-bureaucratic organizations, or if not instances of such organizations, the forms of organizing, have persisted and endured for considerably longer than any kind of bureaucratized form of organization, even if we count to this day, much less so to when he was writing this.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And it's actually, I just want to highlight, it's interesting that you brought up the whole historical aspect, because I think when I reread the chapters, and one of them I only read for the first time, is that I never thought that Weber would dedicate so much to the whole historical context and everything. You know, I thought it was much more matter-of-factual. But having said that, and going to your point, I think the fact that he insists on the enduring character of bureaucracy, the necessary almost, you know, character of bureaucracy, is that it in a way is very fit with the general modern life infrastructure that we have. And he names exactly capitalism and democracy. Because I was reading the many things that he talks about bureaucracy and this whole idea of predictability and calculability of results. And I think, well, for some things, we can compare the way bureaucracy functions to the economic exchanges relation that we have, that is how money changes the way that people make transactions. Because money, you know, as you know, has no boundaries, has no smell, it can be exchanged among anyone. And you have this, in a way, a certainty that can be completely divisible. And when you enter an exchange with someone, you're going to buy something, you don't expect the person to be, you know, looking at you and considering yes or no, or who you are, whatever. It's a very clean cut, if you will, machine-like exchange. And I think bureaucracy creates the same thing. You know, it gives a certain organization to work that gives it exactly a very clear-cut, even though we discussed before that rules are not so clear-cut sometimes, procedures and way of carrying out work, you see? It's less dependent on the personal opinion and the values, as you might think of, you know, a Renaissance guild of professionals, you know, working together and discussing whatever, what is good and what's bad, and joint agreed. Almost like a craft-like idea, and bureaucracy makes more, to use a famous metaphor, machine-like.
Right. I think the monetary economy is fundamental to this. So I think you hit that right on the head, that within this mode of exchange between parties, bureaucracy has a place, whereas when it was that, you get land or power or connections in return for whatever you do, it's not as acute, I suppose.
One good example that I remember from the text that he talks about the comparison of how law is today and how it was a modern time trial in which you were not sure what's the rule guiding the whole process. It was a case-by-case situation. And now we have this more, at least some legal context more than others, this whole idea that, you know, the rules should speak by itself in a way. You have more expectations of what's considered to be right or wrong.
And then he complains how England did not adopt civil law and stuck with common law.
I didn't want to open that box.
Right. And I really enjoyed his comments about the United States at the time, that as a highly de-bureaucratized, anciently organized place. And now, I checked it, in 2010, U.S. government employed 2.8 million people, not counting military personnel, which would bring it to 4.4.
Wow.
Which is a huge organization.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, absolutely.
Okay, so I think I'm going to try to do a spin on this whole thing of rules. May I?
In a way.
Please.
Okay, so one of the things I keep thinking, and I'm going to bring Toyota again, but just for a quick moment, is that if we accept that the point of too much rules or too many rules is not necessarily the quantity, but, you know, the extent that people have the ability to pause and think, and instead of just doing a workaround to change things, of course, I understand that's not only feasible and there are limits. I'm going to push a bit further on the idea of rules and too much bureaucracy, too little bureaucracy. Because I was reading recently about the catering industry in California, because I think there is a guy that just completed an ethnography about, I think he worked, I don't know if it was undercover or not, but he worked in the catering because he was interested to understand that whole aspect from, I think, an ethnic market kind of perception, because a lot of those jobs are occupied by first arrived immigrants and so on and so forth. And since they many times are not legally working in the country, that's in California, they don't have any kind of say back to management. And one of the things he noticed is that actually it appears to me that there is a lack of bureaucracy in that situation, because he says that there is a thing that he calls a mock schedule. That is, employees never really know when they're scheduled to work. So management should expect them to be available in weekends and so on and so forth when there is an event. And even when they go to the event, they are there. It might be the case the manager say, no, you should go home because we're not going to need you today. And one interesting aspect of rules, you know, to spin what Miranda was saying before, is that in principle, the rules exist to everyone. You know, the rules are not only for the employees, but also for the more ruling powers of the organization, if you follow me there.
Yeah, actually whoever says that the managers are superiors are just as the rules as other employees.
So my provocation is more a provocation that, okay, we accept that sometimes rules become too complex. It's hard to discern how to change them and who's entitled to change them. What is the hierarchy behind it and how hard it is for people to even grip the whole process. But I think there are, even in a modern economy, moments in which there is too little bureaucracy, and that is negative many times for the workers, actually.
Right. Well, I think we're back to Weber's initial concern then, because when you say that there's too little bureaucracy, presumably what you mean is that there isn't enough rule of law or rational administration.
Yeah.
Irrational in a way that it's fair to all equally. Oh.
If you can go back to Goldrin, that's exactly his point. No, it's predictable for the manager, but it's not more predictable for the worker.
Right. Well, yeah, in that case, then there is, of course, a lack of bureaucracy as a form of leadership. Because one of the key things that bureaucracy is based on is, of course, this distinction between types of leadership that he has, that the charismatic, the traditional, and the rational legal.
Yeah.
And the charismatic being that you give commands and run things based on your charisma. Traditional is hereditary. You are born into a position or you inherit it in some other way. And the rational legal is his big favorite because it is spelled out in forms of formal procedures. In the event of what you described, that is not merely lack of bureaucracy, it's an absence of bureaucracy where you have some kind of a strange, almost coercive leadership, and not physically coercive, but economically coercive. We see a lot in the various shows that take place in California where you have a minority housekeeper or cleaner, and then they're threatened with deportation. You know, it's that sort of thing that is fundamentally a-bureaucratic. So I guess where I'm going with this is that if we are to have a discussion of bureaucracy, this condition for rational legal, I don't think he used the word leadership. I'm sort of missing what it is that he used with, let's say, management or administration. It needs to be in place.
Authority. I think we can just say authority.
Yes. Thank you. So that needs to be in place prior to evaluation or in Weber's case, imagination of bureaucracy as such. It's a tool, but that is the power that the tool runs on. If you plug it in elsewhere, it just doesn't work or it burns out.
I think I'm going to continue with my provocation. I have a follow-up on that. Is that because, you know, as part of my work, one of the things that I keep reflecting on exactly this juncture, you know, what's the right size of bureaucracy? What's the moments in which bureaucracy is actually enabling, not only coercing? You know, what's the minimal level of bureaucracy? How does bureaucracy work as an infrastructure for modern work? And there is an interesting paper I recently discovered. I think the title is From Iron Cage to Iron Shield. And the person is making a case, which is very interesting because it's about knowledge workers. And I think it's professional service firms or maybe even doctors. I can't remember right now. But anyway, any kind of knowledge workers dealing with the public directly. And he makes the point that, okay, formalization has been credited to be something negative because it takes away, let's say, the autonomy of the worker, the decision power and everything and so forth. But one thing that it does is that by making things less case by case, but again, more predictable, it also gives a shield for, that's the metaphor he uses, for these workers to switch around much easier a case to each other, a person in this case. You know, so they don't have to work longer hours and just stay in the office for, you know, like dealing with the thing that's coming up. It's much easier to hand off things to each other because it has been standardized. I think that's an interesting, unexpected, if you will, idea of how the metaphor of being a cog in a machine is actually sometimes positive.
I agree with you because it goes back to that rule of rules, but rule, I mean, got work by rules, right, as opposed to fiat and just what someone's personal preference are. And Weber does talk about that, about how that helps people and restep people's ability. So that certainly seems like that would be the case.
It sounds that your provocation is based on the presupposition that bureaucracy is undesirable somehow.
Oh, yes, I think that's the whole problem. Even before Weber, already bureaucracy was understood as a negative term. The problem is we don't have that positive term to describe the same thing. It's only one term.
Yeah, I struggle when I'm explaining to people about the nature of bureaucracy and it just is an organizational form.
Yeah.
Because I always worry that they're going to think I'm criticizing it. Yeah. I'm trying to say, no, in fact, there's many things that are positive about bureaucracy. It is just a way to organize work.
You know, and coming back to what you said before, the whole, what is bureaucracy going, what is necessary, you know, which, what is, does it relate to in the first place, that when I was going through the text, I noticed many things that he discussed that I never expected to be there. For instance, he insists on the idea that a bureaucratic organization of work requires the existence of salary, the existence of careers, and so on and so forth, which is something that's so taken for granted. Oh, even if you think about, you know, the general idea of, you know, there must be a common standard for how the things are going to be run. There seems to be some predictability. It cannot be only, always case by case. In a way, it's the hallmark of the very infrastructures you have today. It's hard for me to think of a formal organization, which is a term that doesn't have the future, you know.
Right, but how about that whole emphasis Ben Ricks on the separation of personal from professional interests, right? The strategic spheres of concern or influence and that they shouldn't cross. And the idea of
I love that you brought that up because it lights always a fire, a feminist fire on me when someone brings a personal, whatever, a private.
I know. So, what do you mean?
Well, I would leave that offside for a second. But I think when I was reading that, I was like, I can think of many work settings and work and jobs in which it's very hard to tease down this personal, private. So, for instance, I don't know, I instantly think about diplomatic people and I don't know the way they, many people live in the embassy, you know, when they go abroad. So, and how much their personal lives is intertwined with the professional because they're representing a country and the very big undertake. So a lot of what you do, or even what you call personal time, is still work. I don't know how much sometimes organizations require people to bend their personal life to fit in, such as by traveling as a case of diplomats, but also the case of relocating your whole life. I understand what Weber is trying to say because he's trying to say that, you know, there is something called as an office that's not the person, so it can be appointed to office, and this office is going to keep existing once the person is gone, which is a much modern idea. But when you start like opening the box of the professional and the private, I see a lot of, you know, messy things.
It shows a dead end. It's a dead end to say, well, I'm going to create this thought experiment, this perfectly rational organization, its ideal form. Mm-hmm. I think Dimitri was talking a little bit about that in the first part of the podcast, because I think that it's not as unrealistic, I don't seem possible. And so, sure, you can learn about organizations, and I think they've made great contributions to understanding basis of rules and why it's important to have as much separation as is feasible from personal, you know, financial gain and interest and those sorts of things. But I think our more modern understanding, what the current understanding we have, is that, well, you know, if you go to certain workers and you say, yeah, I want you to check all that personal interest and your personality at the door when you walk in, and then don't bring that in the building, and then just function as this rational actor or being, I think our current understanding of work is that, or at least on some theories, is that leaves a lot out of the organization. And then not so you talked certainly about some cares and power issues and that, those sorts of things. But there's, for example, there's this possibility that says, okay, yeah, so how are you really benefiting from diversity? If you tell people, yeah, we want you to come in the door, but just follow the rules. And just everybody just follow the rules. And it's all about compliance. And those things that make you, they don't add value to the workplace. I mean, that's essentially what I think. I don't think that ever comes around and says that. That's essentially what the argument entails. And that's contrary to our current understanding of work and relationships with people.
I think there is value in that kind of a thought experiment insofar as you treat it as science fiction, which in many ways it is.
Okay, I'm going to say it.
While, Pedro, this sparked a feminist spark in you, for me, it awakens my inner Marxist.
Okay, feminism came from Marxism, so you can build that.
Yeah, because to do horrible injustice to Marxist philosophy, basically, not to diverge too much from the topic of our discussion today, in a very, very rough way, what you do is who you become. So it's more complex with the material conditions and the social struggles and all that kind of stuff that we really don't need to go into now. But how can you divorce office from personality when your personality would mirror or be absorbed or absorb the office eventually, especially when you have these claims about lifelong employment and devotion to the bureau, the office? It's very odd not only to find space to separate personal from professional or bureaucratic at the very least, but even to sort of make such a claim. And given the tradition that he was writing in, of course, he was well aware of Marx, all his ideas, or some part of them anyway. Also, in more contemporary organizations, we see a drive towards integrating office and personal. The creative companies that are quite famous for this, they are known for encouraging their employees to bring personal into the professional and to enrich the professional through the personal, and to not have a separation or the proverbial work-life balance, but just do what you fancy doing, really, and hopefully be happy as a result. Address your calling and enrich, improve, and innovate in the area of organizational life, be it probably more private than public, but still.
It's almost the case that the whole life goes to work.
Building on your considerations, I think a good summary would be that of talking about the fact that there is a greater emphasis on identifying oneself with the job that you do, with your work. And this is something that they've either ignored or nearly just didn't put into the picture. So I find it quite curious and at the same time, something quite difficult to understand, because for me, it's quite automatic to think that what I do actually builds a bit of my identity, and my identity is also reflected in what I do.
That's recursive.
It's one of those cornerstones that when I don't see it, I really don't understand.
So I get Weber's concern that, and I think his ideas and opinions of the people are reflected in this slightly. He was concerned with corruption primarily, that he wouldn't want people to use public office for personal gain, which is, of course, something currently pervasive. But okay for a public office, especially in a heavily bureaucratized government administration, that where bureaucracy essentially controls resource distribution within the country, but certainly not so, or at least not as much so, in the public sector. And we know that capitalism is in large part motivated by personal interests, and there are certainly power aspects of it that one would not want to ignore. Claiming as he does that bureaucracy is a one-size-fits-all approach to both the public and the private seems to miss this point, I think.
Which point specifically?
Oh.
Okay.
Well, the motivation and private separation.
It misses the point that corruption as a threat in the public sphere. So, okay, not jumping ahead a bit, but importing the personal into the professional may cause different results, whether it's in the public or in the private. And
okay.
Of course, bracing for the worst, corruption would be such a result in the public, mm-hmm. as it may well be in the private, of course, but the implications would be different. And his concern preserving the state or a governing apparatus warrants that to an extent, but I think it's missing a larger point that what we talked about, what goes and all that sort of thing.
No, I love it. And I'm very glad that you brought that up. And I remember actually when we spoke about Taylor, we had like a similar conversation, you and me, Dimitri, in which you asked me, what do you think is the difference, you know, to think of bureaucracy in the private sphere and public sphere, it's all about authority and so on and so forth. I really agree with you now that there is a difference that Weber doesn't capture, especially because, as we know, he was talking about two things at once. He was talking about the officials, the public administrators, or just the public employees, if you want to really expand the idea, and also the bureaucratization of work in general. I see a big difference, not only regarding this thing of the separation of office, but also the general nature of the work, because you know there are many of the negative things of bureaucracy, such as the idea of red tape, you know, that Merchant has written about goal displacement, that people get so caught up in the rules that they just focus on the rules and themselves and just forget what the rules are for and the general purpose of their organization. I think that all those things are, they exist in a different way in the private sphere, mainly because you can, if you don't get the targets, you know, the objectives that is set up from the higher ranks, you might as well just be replaced. You know, so there is less this idea of, you know, people become so self-absorbed in their own work and just thinking about their careers and being so scared about, you know, doing something different or going one step further than the rule. Because in the private sphere, there is much more, you know, the overarching demand is not only abiding to the rules, being, you know, so much about the calculability of results, if you were to go back to that idea, but also about what you produce. How is the company, you know, bringing what's supposed to be, which is profit or, you know, sales increase, or even if you go to a broader perspective or technology advancement, if you're in a research setting or any others.
In this light, it's especially interesting the advances we have in new public management at the moment.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, maybe advances is the wrong word to put it, but
changes.
Yes. Sort of evolutions of how this private aspect of bureaucracy is being overspilled into the public, mm-hmm. but deliberately.
Yeah. I want to just say two things. I think it's impossible to resist to talk about bureaucracy, especially among us, which some of us do research about knowledge workers, is that I would like to know how you guys feel about the whole idea, the more current idea of, you know, bureaucracy is best for knowledge work and so on and so forth. And Dimitri, you brought something about this whole idea that, you know, people are expected today to bring actually their creativity, bring their whole selves, you know, to use an expression at work. So would you classify these things as new bureaucracy? You know, are there changes in bureaucracy? Is bureaucracy bad for knowledge work? How would you guys frame that?
Well, for me, it's what is bureaucracy in a very loose sense, which is what I prefer to stick to as a rational legal authority. Mm-hmm. I think bureaucracy is inevitable. And everything is bureaucracy in that way. Any kind of a formal organization or a formal arrangement is then bureaucracy. And because of that, I'm not a keen follower of the post-bureaucratic organizational chatter, because I think it's focusing on the properties of the bureaucracy rather than on the system itself.
Okay. But thinking less about labels, for instance, do you think, because I know that you have some expertise on project work and project organizing, would you say that project organizing or projects can be bureaucratic, or are they a break from bureaucracy because they are horizontal? And we said that at the beginning, you know, that Weber never spoke about the horizontal dimension of bureaucracy.
Right. I think project work is at times even more bureaucratic than more traditional forms of organizing work, not least because bureaucracy has to be replicated and established within a project in order for work to continue. But or begin, but also because all the work parties that are involved in projects, especially if a project is inter-organizational, they tend to bring their own bureaucratic baggage into the project.
Okay.
So it's almost double bureaucratic in some ways. And that I have observed in the architectural study that I recently finished and before, which is, I think, what you were referring to. It was work on a management consultancy that dealt with actually instilling a different form of bureaucracy in organizations, that this can cause difficulties and misinterpretations of certain ways of doing things. Obviously, bureaucracy is, as we mentioned, a tool towards the tool of work, and tools of work, even when the same item, can be bureaucratized in different ways, so thus causing various inconsistencies and incompatibilities between how people even work with the same kind of stuff, really. To summarize, yes, I think, what did you ask?
Project work is bureaucracy, or is a break from bureaucracy? And
no, in that case, no. Project work is not a break from bureaucracy. It is a slightly haphazard incarnation of it.
Okay.
But I really wouldn't want to attract so much criticism from so many people who write otherwise.
But I'll quote you on that.
Yes.
I agree with Dimitri that there's projects don't lack bureaucracy. It's just different kind. And I have seen the situations he talks about where you have mesh bureaucracies. Two organizations work differently with the same thing or same concept. So it does get challenging. Although you do see sometimes the organizations make a specific effort to reduce the amount of bureaucracy and give the projects more flexibility to go get stuff done. So it can go either way. It depends on the organization. Some organizations see their own bureaucracy as an anathema to project functioning and innovation. So they actually try to cut back on it.
What is bureaucracy when you say this? It's presumably paperwork and procedures.
Yeah, and I'm just saying they cut back on the types of paperwork and procedures to streamline things. So I'm not saying there's no bureaucracy. I wasn't trying to argue that. I was just saying you try to simplify it.
I know. I'm not trying to challenge you, but this is something that comes with the word bureaucracy, that paperwork and procedures, they're just aspects of bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And especially from what we read.
Yeah, there's more. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So it's a far more complex array of things and ways of doing work, even insofar as it goes to replicate itself, than just the proverbial red tape. And I think that, if anything, is one of the key things that we can learn from Weber, from these readings.
On that note, should we share our key learnings from this reading?
Sounds good.
Sure.
I think I just have with mine, so.
You just did, actually.
Yeah, so you go ahead.
So the features of the reading in Weber's philosophy that kind of struck me is a big takeaway. With that, his idea that the bureaucratic administration is specifically rational through its domination by incorporating knowledge into the work. And that's where you get the whole professionalization of the work and boundaries and a technical ability that Dimitri was talking about. That was number one. And then number two, his thought that bureaucracies are more rational and that makes them more superior to other forms of organization because they're more efficient. And he didn't really state that they were necessarily better or wiser or, in the ideal case, what should be the case, but they would tend to drive out other kinds of organizational forms. So I just think that's interesting in light of this thought experiment that he did about how work should be done.
I think I have more or less three takeaways. So the first one is maybe being already said it. The idea of bureaucracy, that there is more to it than what has been left to us in the sense of the word in its everyday use.
Yeah.
So this need to go into it a bit better. And it's kind of unfortunate that in everyday language, we only have the negative connotations of bureaucracy. But that's definitely another discussion. Another aspect is this assumption of obedience, which kind of is theorized as if it were automatic. And I think that is definitely a shortfall of Weber's discussion. And on a final note, I would put in the idea of the lack of a focus on the understanding of the sources and of the purpose of the set of rules. Mm-hmm. So those would be mine.
Yeah, I think mine also reflects a bit of what you guys all said. The first thing I think was interesting for me is that I realized how much sometimes going back to text can actually talk to a lot, because I knew I have read some of the parts of the Weber text on bureaucracy, but it's almost like a spiral. You know, revisiting it and discussing with you guys, I think getting new ideas, which is very refreshing. And I think it was interesting to read him now because I really like the fact that we have been reading different genres of texts. You know, we have the typical confessional, almost a practitioner things with Taylor. We have the hard science style things with, you know, the Carnegie Mellon. We have the lecture from Follett, which is much more essay-like. And we have Weber, which is very historic, and you know, it's very sometimes complicated to read, but brings you a different layer to the arguments. And I'm going to follow what Miranda said, is that I think I learned that there is more, and at the same time, less to bureaucracy than I expected, you know. There is this thing that we discussed that it's less about efficiency and more about uncertainty reduction and calculability of results and how that plays out. And also the fact that bureaucracy is, if you will, the infrastructure for modern organization is almost mirrors, it's almost a synonym, is the idea of formal organization. You know, this general idea that you have, what is an office, what is work supposed to be like, and you know, it's not always everything case by case, but there is an expectation of, you know, some continuity, some standards. But the thing to reflect what Miranda said before that, you know, leave me a bit, you know, that I'm missing in the text, is that he never discussed work directly. And that I think that's where it comes from, the whole thing that Miranda was bringing up of the understanding and the human side and so on and so forth, because we never really see how, what does bureaucracy do in practice, you know, because we just have the whole set of characteristics.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.